So good evening, everyone. I'm going to try to get us moving on our official program here. But feel free if you are if you're just finishing dinner and would like to have dessert. I believe that dessert is still available.
How are you?
But I am going to try to move us forward because I know that that there's a few people that we're going to talk a little bit about the state of the system, give you a little bit of information, catch you up to speed if you're not one of the regulars. And but before I get started, let me just say, I want to echo some of the sentiments that Greg and Allison were talking about. So thank you to both of them for all their work on this, making this happen. As you can see, the 80 White Conference has been going on for quite some time. This is the 16th annual 80 White Leadership Conference. But the Alumni Summit piece of it, this is the first year. And tonight, what we will do tomorrow morning and then Sunday morning are all additions to what has already been a great deal of work each year to make the conference happen. And so I really appreciate the work of Greg and Allison, and certainly Kara, who has done a lot of heavy lifting and spares me from having to do conference planning. So thank you so much. And there's plenty of people here that I recognize. There's also some people that I've met for the first time, either in person, maybe I've talked to you on the phone, but it's nice to put a face with a name. And thank you so much for coming. I know that there were some who hoped that there might be 300 people here, but I have to tell you that having attended, I think this is our seventh annual conference, Kara, is that right? We don't always go in a pair, but we've been here about the same amount of time together, and so it's really great to see so many new faces and this many alumni attending this particular session. So thank you all for being here. I have the pleasure to introduce first. I am Travis Apgar. I guess I should introduce myself. Just because I recognize a few people doesn't mean I should assume you know who I am. I am Travis Apgar. I'm the Associate Dean of Students for Fraternities, Sororities, and Independent Living. As I said, I've been here for several years. It has been a complete honor and privilege to work with this system, one of the best in the country. I really believe that, and have the honor and privilege of working with so many of you who are devoted to making sure that this system continues to be here and only gets better. I'm going to be joined tonight in terms of speaking by a couple of people that I have the great privilege to work for. Dean of Students, Kent Hubble, who is also an alum and an Alpha Delt here at Cornell, and our Vice President for Student and Academic Services, Susan Murphy, who's also an alum and a Pi Beta Phi of Cornell. I think everybody probably knows who they are. They're kind of the celebrities in the room, right? So let me just give you an overview of what today's system looks like. And I apologize if I move away from the mic too much, but I'll try to project so you can hear me either way. Because I know that whenever I talk to alumni, the first thing they want to know is, how's the system doing? And that question comes from a lot of different angles. You know, how's the system doing in terms of behaviors and that sort of thing? But down deep, most people just want to know, what are the numbers, right? Because that drives kind of our society in the first place. So here's what I tell you, is that today, we have about 32% of the undergraduate student population that belongs to the Greek system. So over 4,400 students are currently involved in Greek life for this semester. Now, mind you, this is the semester where most people join the system, and it's before graduation. So in the fall, it does, the percentages does drop a little bit. But in general, about a third of our student population belongs to the Greek system. There are currently 63 fraternities and sororities in our system across three different councils. And you can see there that the IFC has 37 organizations, Panhellenic has 12, and the MGLC has 14. For those of you not so familiar with some of these, IFC, Panhellenic may sound really familiar. The Multicultural Greek Letter Council is a little bit newer, but has been here for some time. And is supportive of three sub-councils, so the Asian Interest Fraternities and Sororities, Latino-based Fraternities and Sororities, and historically Black Greek Letter Organizations. In the system, there are 48 houses. I like to make sure I differentiate between how many chapters we have and how many houses we have, because while this is, in many ways, on this campus especially, a residential experience, there are several organizations, as you'll see, that don't have houses, but still have a very strong bond to their fraternity or sorority. And so it's really important that we recognize, well, by and large, this is a residential community. It's not solely so. This is a community that contributes a great deal, not just to Cornell, but to Ithaca and worldwide in terms of the amount of service they do, the amount of money they raise for philanthropic activities, And you know, while this is a generation currently that I think is involved in more of those kinds of activities overall, we know that within our system that that the Greeks actually outperform their non-Greek peers in these areas, that they are doing more service, that they are doing more philanthropy. And some people will say, well, that's because you probably have some sort of a requirement, and the reality is we don't. In fact, I'd be afraid to put some sort of requirement because I'd be afraid they would reduce what they would do. The reality is they do this because this is what they're interested in, and it's fantastic. And just so you see, you know, what they've done in terms of the physical structures, in the last year, more than $2.5 million invested in the physical structures in terms of renovations, upgrades, and so forth. Most of that from operating accounts, but a great deal from gifts from very generous and concerned alumni. So we just went through our formal recruitment period for IFC and Panhellenic, and most of the MGLC organizations also, when they do have intake, do it in the spring. And so I thought I'd give you a little bit of an update on how that went, which was very well, actually. The Panhellenic Council, we had 842 women registered. As you can see, in the five-year average, it's very high, and it's a steady increase every year in the last 5 years. There's been more and more women who actually register. 640 women were placed, so about 76%. And that's about the average for each of the past 5 years. It's around 75% of the women who actually register for recruitment end up in a chapter. For the Interfraternity Council, 794 men and women, and people are probably saying, well, why women? Because we actually have two co-ed fraternities that belong to the IFC, so there are some women who register for IFC recruitment. As you can see there, again, it's the highest number of registrants over the last 5 years. And we ended up with 521 bids signed. That number tends to fluctuate. We're still pretty close to when bids were given out, January 21st. And so by the time that this process ends, which is for most chapters March 3rd, we will know the exact number because it's all automated online now. And so that number will likely grow. It's still pretty high. It's a little bit lower than maybe the last couple of years, but just by a little bit. So in terms of strict numbers, things are going really well. Did you want to add to that, Kara?
You can add 37 new ones for college.
That's true, yeah. I didn't.
We're at so far.
Yeah, so we have 37 new members of Pi Kappa Alpha, Pi Kappa Alpha colonizing.
We're halfway through the recruitment process.
Yeah. So, and then the Multicultural Greek Letter Council works on a little bit alternate schedule. So they tend to start a little bit later than the formal recruitment the IFC and Panhellenic do, which is the week prior to classes. They tend to start in the week after classes begin. Several of those organizations are currently going through intake now, and so that'll add to the overall numbers as they finish up in March. I'm going to ask Susan to come up and talk a little bit about, because you know who better to really fill us in on what Greek life has been and what it is today than the person that's been here much longer than me. So I'll turn it over to Susan.
Well, thank you, Travis, although I did not start back in 1868. But I guess because I was a history major at Cornell, I get to talk a little bit about Cornell's Greek system from the historical perspective. I think all of you know your Cornell history well enough to know that when we were founded by Ezra Cornell, he did not believe in the residential hall system. He thought students should live out among the community because putting them all together in a residence hall was probably an unwise thing to have so many young people living together. I think he was really quite prescient. But be that as it may, it would be no surprise that students wanted to live together from the time they were here. So when our doors opened in 1868, we were founded in 1865, but the first students appeared on campus in 1868, so too did the fraternity system. And in fact, there were five or six fraternities at our very first year of opening, and they provided some of the first housing on campus for any of our students. Our first sorority came fairly soon after. Again, I think if you know your Cornell history, you'll know that we've been open to women since the day we were founded. There weren't a lot of women who actually came, and one of the reasons that Sage College was built was to provide a place on campus for women to live, because that hike up the hill back in those days when people were wearing skirts down to their ankles and there were not paved roads and it was muddy, it was just all the same miserable weather we live in, was tough. So the Greek life has been part of our history literally since the day we opened our door. Now, Ezra Cornell's counterpart, Andrew Dixon White, our first president, had a slightly different view of what ought to be available to students. I think you know he himself was college educated. He had started actually at Hobart and had transferred to Yale and did something that you probably aren't allowed to do in today's world, because you'll see that he was a member of Sigma Phi at Hobart, and then he became a member of Alpha Sigma Phi at Yale, as well as Psi Upsilon. So, you know, all of those IFC rules that we love so much today were still being formed back in the 1800s. He was also a member of one of their secret societies, Skull and Bones. He also was very active. He actually helped found Alpha Sigma Phi here, or Rockledge, as we know it, here at Cornell, and actually served that fraternity as its national president early on. So here you have a fellow who was carving out very new directions in American higher education with a commitment to studies that were practical and theoretical, a commitment to an elective system, which was really unheard of in American higher education, and also a very strong commitment to the fraternity system. So here we are today, and that leadership role that our founding president played and the university played indeed has continued. There is no question that we dominate the Ivy League when you think about a Greek system on our peer campuses. With the number of chapters that Travis outlined, 63 chapters, that's one of the largest in the country. Maybe not the exact largest, but I would think probably in the top three. And so here you have a university that's only 14,000 undergraduates with one of the largest number of chapters. When you think about the size of an Ohio State or University of Minnesota or the University of Michigan, that's really quite something, and indeed one of the oldest systems. We have, again, sort of perhaps no surprise, led the nation as being the home of several Alpha chapters. Delta Chi fraternity in 1890, started initially, I believe, as with an academic focus on law, but has been here straight through. I think many of us know Alpha Phi Alpha's Alpha chapter was here in 1906 as a university that opened its doors to students of all colors, all religions, all races and backgrounds, seeing that fraternal experience that at that point white Christians were experiencing. African American students said they too wanted to have that same ability to bond and have a brotherhood, and so Alpha Phi Alpha was incorporated in 1906. And I will just say as an aside, one of the great privileges of my time as vice president was to be here when they celebrated their centennial, and the gathering that occurred on the campus and filling of Sage Chapel in that celebration was really an extraordinary experience. Sigma Delta Tau, a sorority that was established to allow Jewish women and to have a broader opportunity for women of different faith, was founded here in 1917. Lambda Upsilon, Lambda, L-U-L, a fraternal society that was founded to serve the Latino community. Its Alpha chapter was here in 1982. And then Lambda Pi Chi, the first Latina-based sorority, was created here in 1988. So we have a very old system. We've also been a leader as individual chapters, very much related to one of our great strengths, I believe, as an institution that has welcomed any person for any study. We've also been a leader as a system on what I would say some broader levels. During the 60s, which was when I was here at Cornell and into the early 70s, of course, the civil rights movement was thriving. And Cornell Greek chapters, both initially the students and then the alumni, took quite a position about the discrimination clauses that existed in many of our organizations. And it's some very interesting historical reading if you go back into the archives, where you see our student leaders starting actually in the late 50s, having a discussion about how wrong it was to have the ability to absolutely exclude students of color or students of different faiths from their chapters. When I was here from 69 to 73, there were a number of national organizations that were locals because our chapters were opening up their doors to students of different backgrounds, and their nationals were saying, well, if you're doing that, you are not a part of our organization. So during my time, Phi Delta Theta was Phi Delta Alpha. Kappa Kappa Gamma was Kappa Psi. Phi Sigma Sigma, that has just come back to campus, went off campus. And there were a number of chapters that went through that period of time. And I actually take great pride in the report that was done by our Board of Trustees called the Saperstone Report, which set as a requirement that for a Greek chapter to exist on the Cornell campus, they had to have the discriminatory clauses in their membership eliminated from their national charter. And it was during that period when some chapters actually had to go local because it took their nationals longer to catch up with where Cornell University took an institutional position. And I think, you know, we could look at what we're trying to do today in that same context. The Greek system, as is evident by this little history lesson and Travis is sharing with us the current data, has a very significant role on the campus. And all of us are here because we had a very defining experience for our own time at the university. Probably our closest friends came from our chapter. For many of us, our leadership experiences on the campus came through our chapter. Some of the greatest problem solving developed because of our chapter. But the system is now existing in a very different time frame. Our universities look different. Society looks different. The drinking age has changed. Our tolerance for misbehavior around matters of bullying and hazing as a society are fundamentally different. And so the question is, how do we as a system, and what can we as a leadership university do to make sure that the Greek system continues to exist for those students for whom it's going to be a vital part of their undergraduate experience, but to do it in a way that doesn't lead with the headlines that too often show up on the front page, but rather might lead with the headlines, as happened with one of our chapters this very month, with Beta Theta Pi having done a fantastic job working with the YMCA to create a whole new park system for this community. And who went out to start that effort? Our undergraduates in Beta as an activity. And to be a local Ithacan and having the front page of the Ithaca Journal show that picture of the Greek system was a very special opportunity. And so we're not trying to end the fun. Sometimes Travis and Kent and I get, you know, accused of being the administrators who are the anti-fun police. I think that's an unfair accusation. But the rules are different and the time were different. So I think our challenge, as those of us who've chosen to spend time this weekend to think about the future, is to help Cornell alumni and students be the national leader as this whole system is trying to find its relevance in higher education in the 21st century. That's our task, and I think we're up to it. So I really appreciate your willingness to join us. And now I'd like to turn it over to my dear friend and colleague, Kent Hubble, to share some words.
Well, thanks, Susan. I think that Susan's ending remarks are very important, and that is we are viewed across the country. Travis and I haven't gone to the AFA meetings in the last several years. Travis has gone much longer than I have. But what I hear loud and clear is that we really are viewed as the leading Greek community in the country. And I guess we've come to the conclusion that with that recognition and reputation comes the responsibility to lead. And so I think what we're about currently is undertaking work that we expect will have ramifications not only for our own campus and our own Greek community, but the community nationally. And I think that David Scorton and his mandate expects no less. So I joined the Office of the Dean of Students in, do I supposed to advance this? Let me just.
The side one.
Is it the side one? Okay. Okay, great. So Susan spoke into the community impact that we've had. Let me give you a little history. I mean, I joined the Dean of Students Office and the Division of Student Academic Services in 2001 and began to reacquaint myself with Greek life in the 2000s. And during that period, as you can imagine, there was a lot of change, as Susan noted, amongst expectations of parents with regard to how we look after the health, safety, and the academic progress of our students. And we became a little more data-driven, and so the staff at Gannett and other parts of the university started looking carefully at Greek life and the various behaviors that are associated with Greek life. And so throughout the 2000s, it became increasingly clear that for all of Greek life's positives, there were some troubling and endemic challenges that we had to face if the system was going to survive and thrive. So in this climate of rising expectations, we continued to do our work. Survey research, as I said, started to inform our understanding of Greek life. At the same time, as perhaps many of you know, that cognitive scientists studying the developing brain had determined that there were a variety of things that had yet fully developed in the teenage or the college-age student brain, among them the ability to judge risk. And all of a sudden, we had new eyes for the term sophomoric, because we then came to kind of understand that being sophomoric was really a developmental issue as much as it was one that was just part of a social environment that students lived and behaved in. So as we started to put all these findings together, we realized that perhaps it would be best for us to speak to the Student Life Committee of the Trustees about these issues. And our report in the spring of 2008 had basically five essential messages to report. First of all, we noted that in Greek life, especially amongst associate or new members, there was a pattern of academic underperformance that amongst males persisted and did not lead to the same GPA at the end of their students' careers that they might have otherwise enjoyed. For women, it was somewhat different. There was a recovery of the academic performance going forward. Second, we discovered that from 2000 to 2008, nearly two-thirds of chapters were found responsible for hazing. Third, we discovered that members of the Greek community consumed twice as much alcohol twice as often as their non-Greek peers. And we also discerned that incidents of sexual misconduct occurred disproportionately in the Greek community. And lastly, while the Greek community is diverse, it's not as diverse as the campus at large. So it does have a tendency to sort of interact in a way that counteracts our mission to create a diverse and inclusive student community on campus. With that said, we agreed that we would come back to the trustees, the Student Life Committee, annually and report our progress. And so we began the process of dealing with this much more systematically than we had in the past. So among other things, we looked to structurally reduce access to alcohol. We wanted to significantly increase accountability. We wanted to increase monitoring. We wanted to invest substantially in alternative activities. We wanted to increase transparency. And eventually develop a Greek-specific alcohol intervention program, which was facilitated by a health collaborative initiated by James Kim, the then president of Dartmouth University, which has been going on for a couple of years now. So we left that meeting, really ready to go forward. And we reminded ourselves again that we are a leading Greek system that has the obligation to lead as a result of that. So we really felt it was urgent that we take the initiative, to create a Greek community that we value in a way that, as Susan suggested, consistent with the mores and expectations of the 21st century. So, as you can imagine, everything changed on February 25th, 2 years ago, in 2011, when George Dedoon died. All of a sudden, all this work that we'd begun rose to a level of increased urgency. And so we have worked hard ever since, and we are now seeing progress. We've convened several meetings in the last month or so, which indicate that we are seeing real improvements in these five dimensions that I talked about. And we're hopeful that they are durable and permanent kinds of improvements that we can build on in going forward. So let me conclude by saying that we need you. We need you and your leadership in this self-governing system that we have. Alumni figure very prominently in the success of chapters. Where we see alumni involvement, we see a healthy chapter. We must shift the Greek system away from the high-risk, stereotypical behaviors that have become associated with Greek life nationally. And we need to redouble our efforts if those currently involved will really benefit from all the things that we so cherish that are part of the Greek system. So my appeal to you is to join us in this effort as we go forward. And we hope that year over year, the system will become better yet and something that we can truly be proud of in the most sincere and complete fashion. So with that, I'll give it back to Travis to talk about things more current.
So thank you, Ken. And that went backwards. We're all new to the clicker, so forgive us. So to echo what Ken was saying in terms of fraternal relevance, making sure that this experience continues to exist for the next 150 years, if not beyond, that's so meaningful to so many of you that's in the room. We know that one of the key aspects of this experience here at this campus, and the reason this is such a strong system, especially in the Northeast, when we look around at the universities that make up the community, we're a unique campus. We have the benefit of having so many devoted alumni, not just to the university, but to our chapters. But we know that we need to see more of that happen, especially as it relates to alumni interacting with our students. And so here's a few ways that that you can be involved. At the system level, there is a Fraternity Sorority Advisory Council, Ralph Wilhelm, who's in the back of the room. Hi, Ralph. Say hello to all the good people. He is the chair, and that is a group that was created in about the mid-90s as a trustee-appointed council that is really designed to advise Susan, Kent, myself on all things that are Greek. And they are represented by trustees, other alumni, student leaders, and then the three of us and some other folks, including faculty. They're also represented on that council are three alumni councils that mirror the undergraduate council. So the Alumni Interfraternity Council, the Alumni Panhellenic Advisory Council, and the Alumni Multicultural Greek Letter Council. And so these are some ways to be involved in the system if you're interested. There's also chapter level involvement, and there's plenty of ways to do that. So most chapters have either a corporation board or they have an alumni association, and there's certainly no shortage of need for chapter advisors, especially advisors to specific kinds of positions as undergraduates. So as you can imagine, those folks who take on the position as treasurer of their chapter might be the first time that they're managing hundreds of thousands of dollars, making sure that all of their peers are being fed and the lights stay on and that sort of thing, and they could use some guidance in that. I mentioned the fact that I really believe, and other folks in the room like Tony Cashin, who's a longtime chair of the Fraternity Sorority Advisory Council, and I like to consider kind of the godfather of Greek life at Cornell, godfather in a very good way. He's heard me say on a number of occasions that I really think that the strength and the backbone of this system is the alumni who are so dedicated. So as Dean Hubble mentioned, there was this challenge from David Skorton in August of 2011. To end pledging as we know it, and that was the part that was pulled out the most and discussed the most, and what we've been working toward. But the reality is that while that was that was a challenge to us to end a certain practice that we know today. While we can debate, you know, whether or not the words mean the same things that he's trying to get at, the reality is that in the Greek community, the hazing most often happens in that process that's called pledging, and not just on our campus, but anywhere there's a Greek system. I have the benefit of not just working here with fraternities and sororities, but I tend to be brought to several campuses around the country each year as a speaker or consultant on the topic of hazing. And so I get to see what happens around the country as well and bring that back to this campus. And I'll tell you that we have been working collectively to try to end hazing for decades with very little progress to show for it. Bits and pieces, there are chapters that can say we've done it. There are some systems that can say we've reduced it. But overall, there's been very little movement. And part of that is because we're going directly at the issue. We're trying to convince people that just not to do it. But we're not changing the construct or the platform in which it's usually happening. Now, it's not always in that form, but the vast majority of the time. And so in a really unique approach, President Skorton said, you're going to have to change the way you bring people in. And it mirrors in some ways what we've done here at Cornell and what our colleagues have done all over the country in terms of the way we bring students into this campus, right? So there was a time when freshmen came to campus, and it was a very challenging period of time. And you know, Dan Meyer can tell you stories about, you know, the frosh hazing that used to happen on campuses all over the country, including maybe ours. Today, if you look at the first year experience, it's nothing but welcoming. I can't imagine that anybody would ever want to leave here after being here for the first few days. It's that welcoming. And we make sure that they have great places to live, fantastic food, they have faculty they can interact with. There's all kinds of support around them. And so when we look at the way that we bring people into fraternities and sororities, we know that there's certain information that needs to be bestowed upon them, that they need to understand the significance of membership in these organizations. These are historically important, and these are organizations that are bigger than any one of us, that we decide to belong to, and that we then take on the responsibility to carry forward. So we have to make sure that we're bringing the right people in the right way, but to do that in a way that actually develops a sense of respect, do it in a way that's dignified, and that really empowers people to feel like this is an organization I have to take care of. The pledge model, on the other hand, by and large, it says essentially, you need to learn everything there is to know to belong to this organization before we'll initiate you, which tends to lead to a sense of apathy once you're actually initiated because you feel like you've accomplished everything. So while this was a challenge for us to end something, what's come out of it is actually a number of creative ideas. What's come out of it is actually much more being created and developed and initiated on this campus than ending something. So let me talk to you about that. There was a group of folks, and there's some folks here that I want to make sure that I recognize tonight, who helped us work through our response to his challenge, to President Skorton's challenge. So Bob Furness, who escaped somewhere, was sitting right here, all the way in the back. Bob Furness. And certainly Ralph Wilhelm and all the other folks who are on the Fraternity Sorority Advisory Council. But Bob was a co-chair of the RARE committee, and RARE stands for Recruitment, Acceptance, Retention, and Education. And that task force spent about a year first learning about the issues, really educating themselves about hazing, about leadership development, about bonding, you know, what literature, data, research exists, and then set out to really answer the challenge that President Skorton put forth and developed a set of 10 recommendations that they delivered to us, delivered to the Fraternity Sorority Advisory Council. And I can't tell you that group was incredibly important in this process. It's made up significantly of students, then some alumni, a couple of us staff, faculty members, some national representatives, and some topic experts, but largely led by alumni and students. And we took their recommendations, we added a few from the Fraternity Sorority Advisory Council and from other campus partners as well as national partners, and developed this really comprehensive model of transformative change. We took all of those ideas And we borrowed the model that the Higher Education Center developed around violence prevention on college campuses. And the reason we borrowed that model to try to put all these ideas into is because the reality is there is no model that exists on a college campus anywhere that has proven to be effective in hazing prevention. So we took this violence prevention model, and we've put things into that. And essentially, you know, look, this is not rocket science, in case any of you are rocket scientists. But we're talking about three particular efforts: prevention, intervention, and response. And making sure that we are focusing on the first and the second before we get to the third, but certainly knowing that the reality of changing human behavior, it takes a long time. So everything that we're doing going forward really falls within these categories of trying to prevent hazing or other high-risk activities around alcohol and other drug use and sexual misbehavior and other pieces. Intervention in terms of making sure that people are well aware of what resources are available on our campus to intervene. You know, we're one of the campuses in the country that developed some pretty unique ideas and opportunities for people to communicate with us several years ago, before most campuses were even thinking about hazing prevention. We had the hazing.cornell.edu webpage, which is considered one of the foremost sites for information about the topic, as well as this mechanism to report hazing when it's happened or before it happens, and it gets a lot of use. I will tell you, in the last couple of years, it's gotten a lot more use than it used to. People are becoming much more aware of what hazing is and reporting it beforehand so that we can intervene and prevent it from happening. And then, of course, response. You heard Dean Hubble talk about the fact that, you know, we have this desire to increase accountability within our community, especially with our students. And so there's some unique ways we're doing that. We're making sure that we decide things based on the data and research that's available to us, that we're acting in collaborative ways across not just the folks in our office. We have full intention that this is not just a Greek issue. The data nationally and on our campus informs us that hazing is not something that's unique to Greek life. But we're starting here, because one of the important pieces of this model is that we are strategic in our approach. And the reality of trying to do all things at once to end hazing everywhere probably will dilute our efforts. And so we're starting with Greek life. We have a great structure to do it. We have a lot of motivation to do it and good reasons. And so we will spread that to include teams and other student organizations over the course of the next year, and I'll talk more about that. We broke things down into three phases. So the timeline of being able to implement these recommendations from RARE and the Fraternity Sorority Advisory Council, we started last November. And we asked our organizations to buy into this concept that we would move from a pledge model to a total membership development model. And so this idea, to scrap this idea that you have to learn everything there is to learn before you could be initiated, to accept this idea that fraternities and sororities should really be offering you benefit and development opportunities across the entire time that you're a member as an undergraduate, that it shouldn't just end when you're initiated, that it's not about developing just the pledge. You know, it's about developing the member. And there are certainly things around career development, leadership development, interpersonal skills development that a sophomore, a junior, or a senior could benefit from. And a fraternity or sorority, while many of them do that, we need to organize it. We need to put it into a plan so that it's sustainable and it's something that happens year after year. And the first thing that we did to move in that direction is to ask all of our fraternities and sororities on this campus, before they engaged in formal recruitment this spring, to revamp their orientation process, the process in which they're going to welcome their new members, to fit it into a 6-week period of time, which up until a few years ago, you know, we had a 12-week orientation process or a pledge process that happened on this campus. It certainly wasn't healthy for those going through the process in terms of their academics, and it wasn't healthy for the members who were responsible for running it either. We asked them to revamp it, to make sure that it fit in the 6 weeks, and to make sure that every activity that they identify that they're going to have on their 6-week calendar, they could justify how it related to the goals of their orientation process and the primary or core principles of their organization. And they all did that. I have to tell you, I was pretty worried, because you know what happens between November and January break, and they're not here. But the reality is they all complied. and they all complied in a timely manner, and it was fantastic. To read through them, I was incredibly inspired. In fact, some of what we've had as feedback from students is, while at first, you know, obviously we're asking them to change, and there's resistance to that in all of us, I think. But the reality is now that they've gone through the process of designing it, submitting it, and now they're in process, we are hearing more students say, this is great. They realize that they'll be done in 6 weeks, that for the upperclassmen who are running the process, that also means they'll be done in 6 weeks. It forced them to focus on what was really important in terms of the information that they transfer to these new members before they join. So it got rid of some of the things that led to hazing because they were idle time or they had time to fill. So positive things. And every fraternity was asked to, and sorority was asked to have their national organization and their alumni work with them in developing this and sign off on it. And they've all done that. Talked about the fact that they've gone to a 6-week process this spring, starting next fall, and for the semesters following that, it will actually be a 4-week process. We believe that we could do it in 1 month, and that in that way it has less of an impact on academics, and they really do focus on what's important. We know that while the Greek judicial system, which, by the way, this is a, I don't know if we've talked about that tonight, but this is truly a self-governing system. So while we have a relationship with fraternities and sororities through our recognition policy that has expectations, that says, you know, you have to meet these kinds of expectations and policies, the reality is that most of the policies that exist that are applied to a fraternity sorority on this campus are developed by students and enforced by students. And the Greek Judicial Board is a group of students that I advise on process and procedure, not on how they make decisions and what the decisions are. But we know that process sometimes can be a little timely, and not very timely, and that we needed to make sure that we are making that streamlined, that the consequences are significant in terms of it being meaningful, not just, you know, making it really harsh. That's not the significant I'm talking about, but that there is very real meaning in the consequence for whatever infraction, penalty, and that it does help the chapter learn from that experience. We're in process of working with them to do that. I think that they've done a great job of improving over the years, and I have every expectation that they will continue to do that. We also decided that there would be a great benefit to the entire community if we were to be much more transparent with decisions around infractions. And we believe that's so true that we're committed to doing that, not just with fraternities and sororities, but with all organizations and teams. That if there's an infraction from a group or a team or a fraternity or sorority on our campus, that we should make the public aware of that. And for a few reasons. One of the things that we know that's happening in the fraternity sorority system is that they don't hear what's happening with their neighbors next door. They don't know the infractions that other fraternities or sororities have entered into. They might know that they're on social probation. They might know, you know, if a big decision is made, like loss of recognition, they get some detail. But they don't have the opportunity to learn from one another's mistakes. And I think that seems, you know, seems not so productive on a campus that is all about education. And so, and furthermore, the people who are considering joining these organizations have a right to know what the organization is about before they join. And that's a part of it. It might not tell the whole story, and I'm sure it doesn't, but it should be a part that's told, as well as their families. And so we're really committed, and we're in the process of putting up, similar to our hazing.cornell.edu webpage, which does list all hazing violations, and it has been there for some time. You can go back for dozens of years, not dozens, but at least a dozen years, and look at all the hazing violations that have happened, not just in fraternities and sororities, but there are teams and some other groups that are listed on there. Similar, we will have a site that lists all infractions for groups and teams. Increasing individual preparedness. In other words, one of the things that we hear a lot, and I think came from the task force and others, is that our students, while they want to do the right thing, don't always feel as though they are prepared. They don't believe that they know what to do, or how to interact, or how to intervene, rather. So two things that we want to focus on in terms of programming that will help them feel better prepared and be better prepared. One is around leadership development, and two specific focuses. One is pragmatic leadership development, and the other piece is really situational leadership development. How to really navigate in different circumstances when you are the leader, when you're not the leader, when you're in an official position or you're just a member. And the other piece is how do you get people to come along with you when you have the right idea and you need people to follow you down that path. The second piece is bystander intervention. And so we know that people see things happening, not just at Cornell, but in society in general, all the time, and they don't intervene. Sometimes it's because they assume somebody else will do it. Others times it's because they don't believe it's their business or they just don't know what to do. And so we actually have already started to work on the bystander intervention. Every year we gather all of the new members in the spring who are joining right once they've started their process, and we do some education around hazing and what are the resources on campus for them to get help if they need it, and talk about what the Greek system is and what their experience should be like. And this year we actually focused a great deal on bystander intervention and how that applies to what they're experiencing now, but also as students in general. And what better time to do it than when they're, most of them being freshmen, and they're going to be here for the next few years, hopefully really empowering them to take a stance when they see something that shouldn't be happening. And then you've heard us say it a few times tonight, and the reason that you're all here is because we'd really like to increase alumni involvement. You know, while I can stand amongst my peers, people in my position at campuses all over the country, and brag about how involved alumni are on this campus, we know we still need more. That you know, Kara's voice, my voice, you know, the other assistant deans in our office, we develop great relationships and we can give great advice, my opinion anyway. But they listen to you much more than they listen to us. And so we need your help. So the phase one is kind of reaching its end, you know, and there are no hard and fast deadlines, but in terms of when the phase ends, but we're kind of reaching the end of phase one, and phase two is starting to begin. And what we're working on is we're going to continue to research this idea, because one of the ideas is that we should have live-in advisors in houses, and there's different perspectives on what that means, a definition of what their responsibilities are, what are these positions, how will it impact different chapters financially, physical structures. There are a lot of answers that we need to come up with before we make a final decision, but I think that most of us anyway agree that there is a benefit to having increased advisor presence. And so figuring out what that looks like and how to make that happen is something that we're going to start to really devote a lot of time to this semester. Probably the most unique idea, and I think it's just fantastic, to be honest with you, and we've had a lot of people who around the country have seen some of our work at other campuses and called and said, what is this about? And I've said, well, hold on, because we'll still try to figure it out. But the idea of this One Greek Cornell community experience. So if I could put it in a nutshell, anybody who's interested in joining a fraternity or sorority, or anybody who actually just wants to learn more about the Greek experience at Cornell, will have the opportunity to be involved in several different activities over the course of maybe the fall semester that will be designed at educating them, bringing them together so there's some unity and bonding that happens before they ever enter into kind of the chapter-based recruitment. They go into that process much more educated about what Greek life is about, what to expect in recruitment, what to expect in the orientation process, and having those friendships that maybe they join an organization together, but maybe they don't, and now you have unity building across the system. And so a real great, I think, and a lot of people agree with me, so I guess I'm not the only one, a real great experience for people who don't know about the system but are interested. One of the things that we are really committed to trying to accomplish by the end of this semester, and hopefully we can do that, but it's not as easy as it sounds, is amending our recognition policy to require that all chapters, whether you're university-owned or private, allow access for reasons of health and safety to the proper officials. So if somebody's in your house who needs EMT, that you allow the EMT to come in. And I realize that you're all looking at me like, well, are you telling me that people don't do that? And the reality is yes, that sometimes doesn't happen. Because we have a group of young adults in the house who sometimes gauge the situations much differently than maybe we would, who are a little bit more mature adults and experienced adults. And so we actually have had situations where EMTs were needed and they were denied access because it's private property or what have you. And so to just reinforce the importance of taking care of one another and making sure, especially in a climate where in New York State there's a law that protects them in terms of Good Samaritan law, if there's alcohol or other drugs involved, you know, the legal ramifications are mitigated, the campus judicial process, you know, those things are mitigated. So it only makes sense to make sure that they know they need to allow people into the house to take care of somebody who's in medical need. We've been doing an end-of-year chapter evaluation process for some time. There's a lot of great information that they submit to us every year. It's really difficult to tell just how much of that goes on, and the research, or not the research, but the feedback that we receive every year from the students is that it's not necessarily as helpful to them as it could be. And so we're in the process of revamping what that looks like, and we're going to work really closely with the students especially, and certainly with alumni, to figure out what does that process need to be going forward, because what we want to make sure we do is provide them with really valuable information about their performance year in and year out so that they can continue to make internal improvements if any need to be made. And I've talked a little bit already about how we will broaden the scope of this effort to address hazing across campus. And this spring we're committed to developing what that plan looks like. Where does it go next? Who's involved and how? One of the things we saw happen last year, and this is really simple concept that makes a lot of sense to us that we're completely behind, is this idea that there are system-wide incentives for chapters to perform. So to show up to different activities, to participate in things, to perform service, to all the good things that we would ask them to do, and that the councils will keep track of their good performance and reward them. And here's the best part. My opinion. You'd think that the reward would be something big, right? Like $10,000 to do something great in your house. Here's what they were motivated by, and believe me, they were really motivated. The reward last year was burritos on slope day, and I'm not kidding. They showed up in force to the burrito tent to get burritos, and they thought it was great because they were the only people on the slope that could get the burritos, and so it was exclusive burritos. And And so, listen, if it costs us a few hundred burritos to motivate students to do really well and do great things, then we're happy to continue to supply burritos. The other things that we'll be doing, looking a little bit more forward in phase three, is make sure that we institutionalize things like the advisor and alumni support, and also what we can do as a system, through the councils, the alumni councils, through the office, to provide you all who are working with the chapters the proper level of support and information. Really bolster our communications and make sure that it is consistent and unified across the system. One of the things we hear all the time is, I didn't know about that. And we try very hard to get it out to all the places that we think it will reach alumni, but certainly there's room to grow, and we're going to try to figure out what those other avenues are. And then one of the things that the students really felt strongly about, I think, was that we identify a consistent standard across the system for academics. That's going to be a tricky conversation, but we're going to have it. And so that's essentially what we're up to. I know that I try to cover that pretty quickly. It's a lot of information, but what I'd like to do is invite Susan and maybe Ralph, if you'll join us, and I think maybe Dean Hubble stepped out for a moment when he comes back. And we're happy to engage in a Q&A with you all and see if we can answer some specific questions or answer any concerns that you might have had that motivated you to be here, but certainly fire away. Don.
Don't take this the wrong way, but I'm wondering if you had any ideas on qualifications for the live-in advisory.
So we've asked, I think you might know Dale Williams in our office, who's the assistant dean for facilities and finance, actually create a pro forma, start to gather some job descriptions from other campuses as well as what we see already on this campus, but we need to expand that, and so we're developing some of those things in terms of job description as well as what typical pay might look like, health benefits, who do they work for. We're trying to put all that together in terms of what it might look like for the kind of traditional live-in advisor who's an employee who lives there. But also know that we are exploring this idea in a broader sense. So can we accomplish
the limited advisor idea without it being somebody who actually lives in Meade or who is an employee. So we're, you know, we have a pretty broad view on trying to achieve this.
Thank you.
All right, you guys sit over here, and I'll stand over here. All right, Alex, hi.
Could you speak a little bit about the differences between fraternities and sororities in issues like pledging, hazing, what it means differently where nationals are involved, what you see, particularly as sororities and women became more equal on campus, and what are the different systems and in place to differently progress them? Where progress has been better or again less, and how the differences
have been addressed. Let me just start with the first question, with the difference between fraternities and sororities. Sororities spell better than fraternities. That's the first letter, sorry. let me say that in my time as a professional, working with fraternities and sororities for several years, I guess much longer than I probably realized, there is a difference in the way that hazing has manifested itself. So there was a time when sorority hazing was much more mental and kind of, treating each other kind of poorly, verbally, that sort of, attitudes. But the physical side of it was kind of attributed to men, and that was probably true. There was more physical kinds of hazing happening on men's groups. Today, I think that we have seen an increase in physical kinds of hazing with women's groups. I don't know if I've seen that on this campus as much, but I can tell you that I have seen some things on this campus that are definitely beyond what we used to kind of see in terms of increased kind of mental abuse. I'll put it that way.
Can you give us examples without pointing to?
If you really want me to, yes. So on this campus, we actually in sororities, we don't typically see hazing happening in the new member process. That's the interesting thing. And so when I talk about hazing, know that hazing is not something that just applies to kind of the rookies of a team or the new members or the pledges of fraternity or sorority. Hazing can happen to anybody in the organization, as long as it's kind of this either expectation or some condition of membership. So on our campus, when we see sorority hazing, in the last several years, what we've seen is hazing of sophomores who are already members, when the women who have been study abroad as juniors are now back as seniors, didn't have anything to do with bringing the women into the organization, don't know who they are. They then host some sort of weekend activities at their off-campus apartments in College Town. There's a lot of alcohol. There's usually some verbal abuse and tying them up in the basement and treating them poorly. So that's what we see with sororities, and it doesn't happen a lot, but it has happened a couple times in the last several years.
I don't understand. I'm very old, but
I don't think that's true.
We never had hazing. We had all these sororities that wanted to get us in, and they were gracious to us. And I never had hazing. And even the freshmen we took in. This is all brand new. I mean, the women did not do hazing. We had national rules. There was no alcohol, no smoking in the living room. I mean, the national had rules. We didn't need the university to do it.
Well, let me tell you that hazing is not new. Hazing has been happening for centuries. I will tell you that what we see today is about half of the students that go to college in this country have already been hazed when they were in high school. And some of them had a really positive experience with it. There are people who really believe that the challenge of hazing makes them a stronger or better person. And so they get here, and because they had this positive experience, it's something that while it might not exist in the organization or team that they join, they implement it when they become the leader. And so so it's not new, but sometimes it's new to certain organizations, and that's part of the cycle. I think that, Bob, did you want to add to that? Or?
Yeah, I was just going to say that, looking at it's important to look at both the national research and then sort of the Cornell experience. And all I can tell you is it's very different by chapter. It's very different by council, whether we're talking about fraternities, sororities, or multicultural Greek letter chapters. And so, understand that it happens throughout. The hazing experience is one that you know, with the two-thirds to 60% saying they've had, you know, some experience with it. There are certain outliers, which are chapters that have found ways to ban hazing, but I will tell you that whether you look at the national efforts to ban it, which are either taken seriously or scoffed at, or you look at it as a chapter-by-chapter issue, you look at it as a local tradition that develops versus a national, you know, guideline. All I can tell you is I think we all know, working with our individual chapters, that this exists. The question is how to deal with it. I can't talk to experience. I can talk to experience in the 80s. We certainly saw quite a bit of it, you know, personally and across the campus. I think today, if you just go back to the original question, if you talk about fraternities, you tend to see alcohol-related membership activities and activities that go on throughout the year. It's not just around pledging, but as Travis said, most of it occurs during pledging. But you really shouldn't miss the fact that it can occur from somebody arriving on campus. It can occur from, you know, freshmen who have their first experience who go down to a college town apartment. You know, it can occur, you know, long before the formal rush process begins. Sororities tend to be event driven. I think the sorority sophomore example coming back to campus was a good one. Others are big little sister events, where the big sisters and the little sisters are being formed, and what happens around those parties. Others happen when a sorority member goes to a fraternity and becomes, you know, a little sister within that fraternity. That is an opportunity for hazing. Thanksgiving Day events have been an opportunity for alcohol and hazing. So all I can tell you is, on the sorority side, it tends to be more event driven. So yes, nationals have been maybe more successful in saying hazing doesn't belong within the sororities, but the reality is it tends to find its way into specific events. And then when we talk about multicultural Greek letter, you really have to separate Asian interests from each of what we call the sub councils, if you will, because it may be cultural, it may be physical, it may not be as alcohol related, it may be a tradition. It may be something that, as Travis says, somebody brings in, you know, new from a high school tradition, and all of a sudden it shows up in a small chapter of 12 members where you never expected to see it because it was something new. So, you know, all I would caution on the subject is it's lasted so long because it is persistent. It is, for many, an experience that some value, and that's both at an alumni and an undergraduate level. And lastly, it's very... it can be very different chapter to chapter, council to council, and it can change year on year. So it's kind of a difficult thing to always just answer the question, you know, what is it? You know, just as a, sorry for a long answer, but it kind of gives you a sense.
Clearly Bob hasn't done any research on this topic. So this is just his intuition. Let me also just say this about hazing, that yes, it has persisted. One of the real difficult challenges that we have is interpreting the policy and understanding what is hazing, what are we going to consider hazing, what won't we? And there's a really broad spectrum. And so some people might say, you know, wearing a silly bandana to class, to identify, you know, the whole new member class has to do that. Well, that's just silly, that's not hazing. We would say, probably low-level hazing. We all agree that when you force somebody to drink enough that they actually die from it, that's hazing. We're all going to be on the same page with that. I think the important thing here is to know that when you're talking about 18 to 22 year olds, which is the typical student age, especially on this campus, it's really difficult for them to decipher what's safe, what's not, what's silly and probably isn't going to be much harm, and what is. Because those silly things have a tendency to snowball into something much more serious in a very short period of time. You know, so something that starts out as wearing the bandana eventually becomes something serious because one guy decided not to wear the bandana. And so there were some repercussions, and you had to make sure there were really difficult repercussions. Those are things that actually happen very frequently. And so, you know, so we have to understand that there's a broad spectrum of what we consider to be hazing, because it slips into the serious side of hazing, things that cause mental and physical harm very quickly. Let me just go to Dan.
Yeah, I have to duck out, Travis, to meet with the donor, but I wanted to thank Susan and Ken. I came up a day early to touch base with all my friends who are on the, I would call the anti-Greek group in Cornell, there are people who don't want us around. And I have to say that from as many of our friends here that I've heard robust and active opinions about Kent and Susan and the positions they've pushed over the last 10 years, I've heard equal criticism from the other side about you. So if the sign of great management is that you're being pilloried by from the left and the right, after yesterday I was like, wow, they really truly are in the middle, because there's a whole group that I really hadn't kept track of for the last decade and a half. And it was a robust set of conversations I had yesterday. So thank you very much for helping us through the last 15 years, and we have another probably 15 years to go. And I will catch up with everybody tomorrow as we launch it. Okay. Thanks.
Gentleman all the way in the back has had his hand up for a little while.
Yeah, I just have a few comments. I came to the Hill the same year as Susan Murphy, so we had a similar experience in that we missed the Willard Strait Hall incident by a little bit. But I have things that I noted as Susan and Travis were talking, or actually it was Dean Hubble, but a few things I hadn't even thought about when you talked about pledging. I was recruited out of high school to play football, and the first school to recruit me was the Naval Academy. And when I went down there, being a child of the 60s, I didn't want to go to the Naval Academy. I wasn't going to be one of those plebes who got treated like crap for the first year. No way. So we came up here, children of the 60s, and as we remember, and most of us except the younger people, younger being less than 45, but West Campus used to be the guys, and North Campus was the girls. I mean, so what I see going on here, and what I've heard, and what I experienced at homecoming this year, you know, I was very happy to hear you all say, we're starting with the Greek system. You know, to me, the problem is not the Greek system or the anti-Greeks. Kids these days, it's so different, and they're raised so differently with their cell phones, and they don't play team sports anymore. They're all out there on their own, and they need our help with leadership and a lot of stuff. Some of these kids, and Ken, Dean Hubble, when I was president of the Cornell Club of Philly for a couple of years, and he down and spoke to, when he spoke to us, he said, you know, and having met a lot of kids who are coming up to Cornell at the accepted students events and being in CAN, some of these kids at all schools, you know, you wonder how'd they get in. You know, the social skills are very lacking. The confidence is very lacking. So to me, the drinking problems, the things that happen, you know, I'm seeing this as liability protection for the university, and we're starting with the Greeks, but all the kids need it, and they need our help, and that's, what did I miss here? Those were just my comments, but it used to be, you know, you talk about hazing, Travis. It wasn't, well, and there's physical hazing, there's mental hazing, but it used to be the whole university system, that's how it was. The freshmen, you were different. And the only comment I will make is the 6-week time frame, from what I've heard, and I've gotten more involved with my frat house, Delta Upsilon, thanks to Tony Cashin. But, you know, by the time they get through that week, or that 6-week period, the freshmen or the sophomore or new recruits or whatever, they're beat tired. The brothers are beat tired. And I wasn't supposed to get into this, but it's a very tight window that's been created for the people to find, you know, if they're interested in becoming Greeks at a sorority or a frat. It's, you know, I don't know if the sororities are excluded, have that moratorium in the first 6 weeks, but it's a very tight window where they're kind of forced to make decisions quickly. So I talked to them.
They don't do anything in the first semester. So they really leave it up to the week of formal recruitment. So, yes, sir.
Yeah, I've got a I'm older than you guys.
Same age as I am.
I got to tell you, I'm a CIU. So all of you who been in offer, CIU's got a troubled history. But I was also a national champion rower. Won the national championship as a freshman and a sophomore. But I didn't drink. But what all you're talking about is how do you control the negatives. I haven't heard one thing about how do you build the positives. You know, why is the Greek system growing when you have all these constraints and all these restrictions? And you got to stop all that stuff. I'm not arguing that. But you also have to understand, why do people want to do it? What's the positive and you have to recognize that there's something. This is a huge university. Not as big as Ohio State, but it's a huge university, and it's intellectually diverse. But we've developed a system where he said the old system, the old fraternities and sororities can't discriminate. I mean, it's horrible work, but the new ones can. The new ones are going to have black people. They're going to have Latinos and stuff.
No, Jim.
I want to correct that. Let me finish my point. Okay. My point is that if the memberships across the decades are increasing or at least holding, why don't we build on the strengths? Fix the weaknesses, yes. But figure out what the strengths are and talk about what the strengths are. Mm-hmm. And yes, you fix the worst. You lubricate the gears, but you don't just take away the thing. I'm sorry. There's an awful lot here that's good. And you shouldn't throw out the good because of the bad. We fix the bad.
And I, Chip, I couldn't agree with you more. And I'm sorry if in my commentary the positive didn't come through, because I don't think any of us would be in this business if we didn't think there's something fundamentally positive in the brotherhood and sisterhood, in the service to our campus and to our community, in the leadership development, in the cross-generational connections that we have, in the national connections we have because we're part of a national organization. So you're absolutely right to remind us to find the vocabulary, to find examples. It was why I, cited picking up the Ithaca Journal and seeing Beta on the front page for the work that they're doing with the YMCA. So it's something we have to be more intentional about, because there is enough of the bad stuff that hits the headlines, and that's the challenge. And so our work is to try to figure out how can we diminish that so we aren't serving up the softballs to those who want to be the critics of the system, and take all of the positive aspects. The one piece I wanted to just correct you, because I think it's an unfair statement when we talk about Asian interest groups or the historically African American fraternities or the Latino focus. These are organizations for whom those are their interests, in the same way that Pi Beta Phi was created as a Christian organization, and despite our incredibly diverse membership, still has a Christian ritual. Cornell tried to change it for years, but its heritage is Christian, and that's not going to change. The heritage of Alpha Phi Alpha is to celebrate the African American experience. You need not be African American to join Alpha Phi Alpha. Anyone is welcome to do that. So that's part of the change that's occurred. Now, do more students who are African American choose to go to a fraternity for whom that's their heritage? Yes. One of our challenges as a society is to open our doors for all of that, so that I, as a white person, might find myself in a historically black church to understand a different religious experience. I might find myself in a synagogue, even though I was raised as a Christian, to understand the difference of experience. That's part of what this generation of students are doing all of the time. And so we're in the challenge of trying to say, how do we call what we often call the both and experience? How do we let women be in a women's oriented group, but learn how to interact with men's groups? How do you let students decide they want to celebrate the African American heritage, but participate in a historically white experience, which might be a Pi Phi or a DU? How do we cross faith groups? How do we cross political groups? So you can be both of a group and of the whole. And the Greek system, again, has the potential of being a leader. Travis and Kara and Jason and Catherine work with their student councils. It's a perfect example of the both and. You have an IFC to celebrate the traditions in the fraternity council, the Panhellenic, and the MGLC. But those three councils, increasingly, we're trying to help them find ways to work together.
Susan, it seems to me that then when you talk to the public at large, you need to have the yin and the yang. You have to talk about it in both ways.
You're absolutely
right. Not 10-90, but no. And maybe not 50-50, but at least 30-70. No.
And Chip, that's an absolute fair characterization. I think what we are guilty of in an event like this, where we know you're committed and interested, and we know we have some challenges, and we want your help, we skip right over all the positive things that we all have and go right to the problems we're trying to help solve. And so that's a very fair reminder. It's a very fair reminder.
Yes?
I'm a little confused about the whole privacy issue. When I was here, my parents got my grades. And I'm close to seniors, I'm class of 78. And so I recently became re-engaged with LXP, and I'm now told we can't call people mothers, and there are privacy issues. But you talked about transparency and putting things on websites when people misbehave. So can I get around that privacy about calling her mother and just put it on a website? Or how are you getting around this?
Sure, let me be really specific. Yeah, we're talking about, so there's federal legislation, the Federal Education Rights and Privacy Act, that actually tells us that we can't share students' educational records. And so judicial activities, grades, all of those things, we can't share with anybody other than student. There are some loopholes with parents, but for the most part, we try to respect their privacy because of Cornell policy and because of federal legislation. What I'm talking about is releasing group infractions. And so not infractions by members of a fraternity or sorority or team, but group infractions. So if the organization committed an infraction of a social violation, for instance, that organization will be identified, not the individuals. Right. Does that make sense?
The other distinction that I would make is that there is nothing in the federal legislation that prevents us from talking, certainly with one another within the educational institution, but even with others around observed behavior. So there's a big difference between an educational record and observed behavior.
So I'm gonna just go one more last question because I know it's getting pretty late.
I'm just interested about what you think to do, the reasoning behind, I'm interested in the reasoning behind several things, but you know, how you, the pros and cons of this, but I certainly agree with the hazing. I was one of those guys who just said no and I refused to drink the goldfish. My initiation, and I agree with the shortened pledging. I see a problem with the shortened rush. I understand the rush is now 1 week, and I bring up my own fraternity because I just came from there talking about diversity. I teach in the freshman about diversity in the pledge class, and I see my fraternity is primarily a football house now. So it's actually going to, the 1 week rush is going to actually decrease their diversity because the only contact they're going to have, if they only have 1 week to rush, it's with football players. So I see this sort of perpetuating now to be a completely football house when you don't have that sort of 2 months. And I understand it cuts into their academic, you know, academic schedules and things like that, but I think there's a downside of the 1 week. And I just don't see us getting out of spiral now being a complete football house because that's the only contact you can have with the
No, so Bob, I think there's maybe some misinformation. Let me try to clear up. So in the fall semester, chapters can actually have chapter-based informal recruitment starting after fall break. So that leaves several weeks following fall break that
when
they can
fall
actually
break?
Have. What's that?
When fall break?
Usually about 6 or 7 weeks into the semester.
Okay.
It's almost always around Columbus Day weekend.
Okay. So they can actually have chapter-based activities in that time period, and
we're looking to invite freshmen in. Just
yep. As long as there's no alcohol or other drugs present.
Okay. I didn't know that was that question.
The other thing, Bob, that I think we've learned in this shift, even in the first quarter, there are opportunities for the councils, the IFC, Panhellenic, and MGLC, to be in the presence of first-year students in terms of what is Greek life about, you know, from an educational perspective. And because we've gotten into a pattern on this campus, I'd say in the last 15 years, where the only activity chapters were doing were social, big open parties as a way of introducing themselves to freshmen. And that's what has changed. We've got some work to do with the councils and with the chapters to help them figure out all those other ways you can be interacting with first year students that are not around being the social center with alcohol for things that are illegal for you to be doing and are putting your chapter at huge risk. And what you're reporting is what we're hearing, and it's been very helpful feedback to realize that we've got some clarification to do. You know, we don't want the chapters in that second 6 weeks to get their whole class all lined up except for the formal, you know, dotting of the I's. But having some way for our first year students to get to know a bit about the system, you know, in a way that they're not pressured, is what we would like to see happen.
Susan, do you ask the graduating seniors their feedback so that when it's real current, so you get a snapshot each year of the of a four-year experience.
We do. We survey our seniors every other year in a very formal senior survey, and in the intervening years, we survey all of our students, which would include seniors. So it's a slightly different.
How many people answer?
Our response rate runs about 40%. For a social science survey, that's actually not bad. Not just Greek. This is a survey.
It's not just Greek.
No, this is what we're, asking students, their satisfaction with their undergraduate experience, what they think they learned, what were some positive experiences, what were negative experiences, and then there's an opportunity for it to be free flowing commentary, which they're often not shy about.
And Chip, to your point, Greeks are more satisfied with their experience here. They tend to identify that they are better prepared leaving Cornell in terms of being a leader of groups and leadership in general, their communication skills. They feel better prepared for their careers. So there are a lot of real positive aspects of this experience, such as what Susan was talking about, what we want to make sure that we continue to preserve. What's up? You can tell them. It's okay to talk.
I was going to say that if anyone's interested in seeing the results, they put all of their surveys online. It's just institutional research. I can send you the link because clearly I've been emailing you a lot.
So I know that it's getting really late, and I'm not sure if you have some announcements. Yeah. Okay, so Kara has some announcements. I really, again, we all very much appreciate you being here. I hope that you will continue these conversations over the course of the weekend. It'll be interesting to see where we end up in these conversations on Sunday morning once you've gone through all day tomorrow and had some more interaction with student leaders. But thanks so much. Great questions. Keep them up. And